I'm Kay Puttock, welcoming you to KHOI Community Radio's Heart of Iowa, a program featuring a patchwork quilt of artists, public speakers, and individuals of note in central Iowa. Today, in honor of Memorial Day that's coming up later this month, we're featuring local Ames poet Maggie Westfold, who's remembering and honoring deceased fellow poets that she's known well. A small segment of the first part of this program has been aired previously on KHOI's program Local Talk. But now let's hear Maggie Westfold.
Yes, I'm Maggie Westfold. I am an Ames native. I was born at Mary Greeley, grew up mostly in the Colo and Nevada area, went through the Colo schools after fourth grade, and eventually landed back in Ames when I was 23, I believe. We still live in that same house. It's our starter home, and we are one block hospital we were both born in, so we tell people we never got far in life. It's my spot, though, and I, in spite of tough traffic, I love where I live. I asked Kay if I could use my time to do this. I have lost too many friends who are wonderful poets, and I would like to honor them today, talking about how they came to be my friends and then share some of their poetry with you. And I have a couple poems that I wrote for them that I'll also try to include. The first one I'm going to start with is Tomalu Moss. Tomalu passed away in 2002, July 1st of that year, from metastasized breast cancer. She was only 58 years old, and I just had a wonderful conversation yesterday with her husband, Randy, in Cedar Falls, and we talked again about how unfair life can be. She came from a family of women who lived way up into their 90s, but she did not get to. We met at DOT. We worked there together for 10 years. We didn't become immediate friends because Tama was a very scientific mind, and I am not. So we spoke in the hall, and, you know, we were courteous to one another until I'd probably known her for 3 or 4 years, and her brother tragically lost his wife very suddenly and had 2 little children, and she wanted to help him with mothering, and had no children of her own and no experience to speak of. So she came to me one day and asked if we could have coffee regularly. Could I help her know a little more about mothering small children? And so that's how we came to know one another. And our friendship lasted until she died. She became a very close friend. She had a sister, but they never had been close. And I think in some way I became a part of a sister that she, the relationship she wished she could have had. And she was very, very special to me, a mentor with my poetry. She had a master's in creative writing from UNI. And
a scientific mind.
Yes, she did, very much so. I wrote environmental documents at DOT, and she was a specialist in the scientific end of things and just provided data to the writers on the studies on the more scientific end of things for each project. So in looking for her poetry to share today, it was especially fun to open up the 1999 Lyrical Iowa and find that my bookmark on the page where her poem is was a copy of probably one of my last emails from her. This is 1999. This is three years before she died. But I printed this one off to use as a bookmark because it refers to the poem. I'm just going to read you a few of her words out of this email. She says, "So how's your writing going? Well, I hope. I always get a kick out of the thrill you get from it. It's so nice to see such excitement. I felt that way, too. Maybe I'll get back to writing if I can keep this depression at bay. Today has been very, very good for me. I received notice that I placed second in the general adult division of the Iowa Poetry Society annual contest. I got a chuckle because Vince Gotera, the UNI English professor teaching poetry when I was studying for my master's, placed third right behind me.
Wow.
My poem was At Rausch's for Breakfast. It is a visual image of the restaurant life in this little family-operated place in Gutenberg, Iowa, where we like to go."
Now, the depression she referred to, had she only been diagnosed with cancer at that time?
Yes. And the depression was part of part of that struggle for her. So this is called At Rausch's for Breakfast. A clatter of dishes and bar stools, capped with locals drinking their coffee. Outside, cars hustle up to the gas pumps. The flag billows in the breeze. Highway 52 brings tourists, but mostly it's the regular fishing folks who warm Roush's with heat of conversation and coffee and laugh at Roy's twice-worn jokes. Still, it's that picture on the wall that attracts everyone, even when they take it for granted. The duck pond, once part of the big river, 7 Canada geese flying in, almost close enough to touch. Red wings and yellow-headed blackbirds echoing from cattails as green buds force their scales. Steam from his stack of pancakes and sausage hot on the platter coax warm feelings of spring as fog lifts over the bluffs.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Tell us again, where is this restaurant?
Gutenberg, Iowa. It's okay. And my husband handled signing for the DOT, and he said that is a very famous restaurant.
And it's a big fishing spot.
On the Mississippi, yes. That's one of our bigger tourist areas in Iowa, is the Mississippi and northeast Iowa and Gutenberg and the...
Tell I'm not a native Iowan.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was wonderful, and it really invoked the food and almost
yes,
made you hungry.
Yes, yes. Oh, yeah, she put you right there. That is where Randy and Tama hoped they could retire, was mm-hmm. Gutenberg. When she passed away, he said he might land there, but he has not yet. He's still doing well in Cedar Falls. Another poem of Tama's that I found that I know she especially loved, this was also published in Lyrical Iowa the year before that in 1998, and she was a student in a country school at Pleasantville, Iowa, was where she was from, and this is called Annie Finch's Classroom. One can liken Annie's classroom to the woods, to the humming of a beehive in the glen. Our synergistic forces fill the air as students share their lines of poetry and laugh or ask for help to hear a meter. Her class is where we learn to build our skills, perchance to write a sonnet filled with truth. Yet all this while she guides us with her will and thus endears her students to her still. Mm. Yeah, she loved that teacher.
That was a sonnet, right? Yeah.
I think it was. You know, as I read it, wrong page. I don't know if it's long enough. It's not long enough to be a sonnet. Here it is.
Oh,
yeah, it's not quite
short.
Long enough for sonnet, but it has that rhythm to it.
It does.
Yeah,
it does.
Yeah. And... the last thing I'd like to read in this part about Tama Lou is, this is one that I wrote, about 6 weeks after Tama died. I went to visit Randy, spent an afternoon with him. And this one I wrote in the days after I came home. It's kind of a retelling of my time with him that day. And it was published in Lyrical Iowa in 2008. It's called Singing Tama Lou. Beyond the window, a low rock cluster. A pie pan, perched for rainwater, for twittering chickadees to sip. From her portrait in red on the wall, eyes like dark diamonds shone as if she'd soon speak. He shared 34 years of shoebox photos, her poems in praise of his passion for roses, for bass. 7 love letters scripted on soft pink linen, she had tucked in the folds of the navy dress he most loved to see her in. He sang her name for hours, let the sound of her roll across his lips, Tama Lou, Tama Lou, Tama Lou. Lifted strands from her necklace tree, lapis pearls and malachite, his gifts for his precious gem. He listened to my sadness and my joy. He let a sister friend lament in harmony with the one who knew her best and loved her most.
That's and just wonderful. I got
thank
really
you.
Choked up with that.
Yeah, thank you. I was afraid when I was putting this program together that I might have that kind of problem case. So far, I'm all right. Because this has really been an emotional trip for me, pulling this stuff out. I've lost too many poetry friends, and it's no fair, says me. But they are gone. So that is the part I wanted to share about Tama Lou, and I told Randy yesterday on the phone, we had a very nice visit, and I said, you know, there's still one more poem I want to write, and it's called Randy and Tomalu, a love story. They did not have children, but they were a very committed, in-love couple, and it was very hard to see him alone.
Wow.
She did not...
That really comes out in that poem, Mark.
Yeah.
Thank you. The devotion.
Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, there. He's still devoted to the loving memory of her, and just as she wanted, he has moved on and has a wonderful friend, and that's what Tama wanted. She didn't want him to be alone, so I'm happy for him, and he's doing well. My next poet, who is now gone, her name is Maggie Rotman, another coworker friend. Maggie and I worked at DOT together also. These poets are all over the place. Actually, the third one I'm going to do today is another DOT person. Maggie passed away at 66 years of age, December 28th of 2014. She was suffering from Lewy body disease, which is a combination of Parkinson's and dementia.
At least in its symptoms, yeah.
Yeah. That was especially hard for her, I know, in that she had watched her father die from Alzheimer's, so she knew that part of it. You know, had lived through that. So it was a sad, sad thing and not fair, as I say, but we don't get to control those things. She was an extremely talented artist in many ways. She was a leather artist. She did beading. She painted. She wrote poetry. Talented, talented woman and very giving of all her crafts and things. I have several gifts from her, a hand-bound book with a leather binding. And, she even made my gift tag out of leather and... We talked about a lot of things in our years. We didn't always agree on everything. I told her sis, Judy Jackson, after Maggie left us, I said, I call our friendship a hard-won friendship, but we ended up being good friends. I loved that. She was a special lady and was just starting to enjoy her retirement fully when this disease hit her. We both wrote government documents, and we both knew that we preferred poetry. So we would spend our coffee breaks.
That's not a difficult choice.
Oh, that was a struggle to keep your mind focused on the right thing. But the first poem I'm going to share is from 1981. It was published in Lyrical Iowa, and it's kind of special to me because that's back in the years when I was helping her. I was raising kids and working and all that. So I didn't have a lot of time for poetry then, and I loved to read it. And she would bring her poems to work for break, and I would help her select the ones to submit to Lyrical mm-hmm. Iowa. You can send five in. And so this is one that I helped her select, and it was published. It's untitled. Stop to say hello and maybe sit by your side. Rain outside. I want to leave the dampness there, but share the spring night. My mind has traveled many miles to nowhere, yet somewhere I have drifted to 1,000 thoughts. My life has roamed the days up and down, back and back again. I wonder why I can't really see the sun or feel wet grass under my feet. I wanted to speak profundity to you or laugh with excitement, but I haven't. I only came to say hello. The next one of Maggie's poems is also published, 2009, Lyrical Iowa. It's titled Evening Adieu. In sun-splashed, tumbled-down day, flashes of crystal memories refract through the space between you and me. I watch you turn to leave, a vague, uncertain figure disappearing into golden autumn sunset. You didn't say, see you later. You gave no hope of another, hello, glad to see you. Take my hand. In the purplish blue suffusion of dusk into cool dark, I whisper soft adieu, boldly striding into moon-splashed, silken night. And that reeks of sadness to me. I didn't ask her for details about that. It just seems sad. And now I'd like to read what I wrote after my last visit with Maggie. She was at Bethany Manor, and she passed away about 3 months later. When her sis called me to tell me she was gone, I told her I felt so bad because I had not been able to make myself go back. She knew me that day, and I kind of knew the progression of these diseases, and I was selfish. I didn't want to give up when she knew me.
Yeah, I was wondering. That first poem you read of hers, the untitled one, Mm-hmm. Whether that was, had she been diagnosed at that point?
No, that was way early in her life.
She wasn't sort of imagining what.
No, it could have been when her father was going through that, so she may have been concerned of something like that, but she was a very emotional lady. I discussed that kind of thing with her a lot in our years working together. She struggled sometimes with those emotions and had lots of long talks about that. But this piece that I wrote following the visit that day, another coworker friend went with me. We kind of leaned on one another to go see her because we both had been close to her, talked to her so many times, and knew that it was not going to be easy. This is called A Visit with My Friend in Room B22. You are only 66. Porcelain peach complexion, very little salt peppered in your dark, glossy hair. We were cubicle neighbors, worked together for Big Brother for a quarter century. You look at me and say slowly, "We grew up together through the 80s and 90s. Your translation of those years offers me a way of thinking about them that has never crossed my mind before now. Yes, we did, friend. Indeed, we did. And I like that, remembering our times, good and otherwise, in that way. We all grew up together." You look away, then haltingly, "Your new normal for now." You speak of someone from back then, still held in your heart. A first name is all that remains. I wait, and then I offer a surname. "Yes," you affirm. "Would you like for me to say hello, that you have memories?" "Yes." Tremors. Then your hand lifts a Sunday paper cartoon clipping from your side table, a drawing of multiple cubicles depicted as a maze, and the cartoonist has drawn no way out. Yet another attempt at office humor. Looking at the paper in your tremoring hand, you say to the air in room B22, "This is my mind now."
She said that aloud.
Yeah.
Gracious.
Her mind was very clear on some things, and that's what was so tragic. She knew where she was and what was coming, and no choice about any of it. She, at that point, her sis said, I asked her sis before we went for that visit, "Is she able to enjoy her leather work?" And she said, "No, sadly, she's lost the ability to follow process." Mm-hmm. So she couldn't do her crafts.
Other, yeah.
But she had with her in her room many of her treasured pieces that she'd done. Mm-hmm. But my goodness, when I attended her memorial, there was a wonderful display that her family had shared with everyone of the things that she had created, a leather bedspread with beading that was absolutely gorgeous. I think it was like I don't know if it was a regular double or a queen, but the work in that and the beautiful,
imagine.
I know, I didn't know she had done a piece that big in leather. I'd seen her purses. I have a purse. I have the book. I had no idea the extent of her leather work. Very, very much.
Beading.
Uh-huh, yes.
I mean, leather's pretty tough.
I know.
Trying to sew.
I think she just processed a lot of things in her life while she beaded. I know that's the way that art goes. But her poetry also was, Maggie wasn't high-tech. Her scrapbooks of poetry were so organized and all together. I'm so envious of what I saw there because I have piles of paper and very little organization and need to do that, but she always did that. But what a loss. Kept coming up with more names of poet friends that I have lost that I could talk all day about. So this next one, though, is Ed Fox, Ames guy. Many people listening will know that name. The line at his memorial service was snaking and ongoing. It was quite impressive. I knew him around Ames, and for many years, another DOT coworker. He died of a heart attack on Thanksgiving Day, November 20th, 2014. He was 66 years old, shoveling snow, I believe. I didn't know he was interested in poetry at all, and he did not know I was. After he retired, he took a haiku class from one of my fellow writers, Dennis Malsby, who teaches haiku. Well, Ed took that class, and so he followed Dennis to our third stanza writing group. And when he walked in that night, he saw me sitting over there and said, "What are you doing here?" Mm. And I should have said right back to him, "What are you doing here?" But I was happy to see him. He's a great guy, and I thought, I didn't know you write poetry, but let's hear it. So he was loving haiku, and he quickly fell into loving all kinds of poetry. He was doing so great with sharing what he wrote and loving the writing and the group, and he left a big void in his wake. I knew him for years, but I didn't know him. When you become writers together in a group, you become acquainted really quickly, because memoir and poetry, people write about happiness, about many times about sadness, and you get into the depths of your life. So it's a quick way to really get to know one another. And so I finally felt like I was really getting to know Ed. I have a piece here that Mary Richards wrote. She's in our writers group, and she wrote this for Ed right after he died, and she says it so well about the way all of us felt. I thought I would start off by reading this. It's called Lines for Ed. How surprising, a completely casual relationship. Conversation and comments as poets meet and share gives rise to such regret and loss upon its sudden ending. I want to turn back time, see Ed's smile, return his greeting, hear his joyful laughter, watch his careful kindness as he compliments a novice or soothes a writer's mind upended, hear his sturdy verse children share stories from his life. I should have held those moments close, savored them as gifts ephemeral and fleeting. Now, memory made keen by sadness must suffice. And that is exactly how we all felt and feel, because he is dearly missed. I had a nice talk with his wife, Mary Susan, last night, and she was so pleased that I was going to do this, and she said Ed would just love it. I knew he would. He was loving poetry. He would talk. He was very open about, I want to get good at this, you know, and he was getting good at this. The first one I'm going to share, when he read this one that night, I had been traveling, and I had just come home, and this is the way I found out that a good friend of his and another guy from DOT that I knew had passed away. I was unaware. This is called A Quiet Place. Local pioneers reside at St. Petrie. Most were farmers. Several small Iowa towns can be seen from that pleasant little high spot. This quiet place is caressed by adjoining corn and soybean fields, and shaded by a smattering of oaks, elms, and hickories. My friend Bill recently moved there, escorted by family and friends. A gentle breeze blew, sun felt warm upon my face. It was like someone touched me and said everything will be okay. Well done, my friend. The other one, the deacon at St. Cecilia's asked me to read this the night of his service, or it was the night of the wake, the night before. His funeral was the next day. But this is a piece that Ed had written and shared with Kay Aitchison, deacon's wife, and she especially loved it. And she said, I think it would be so appropriate if someone from Third Stanza would be able to read this for him, and I was honored to do that. And I happened to know the priest that this is about, and it's especially meaningful to me because this priest was so close to my mother, was so close to him, she considered him her sixth son. Mm-hmm. She had lost a child before she had 12 children, and her baby that she lost would have been the age of this priest. Oh. And she always said, I think of him as the child I lost, and he had been so good to my mother. This is called Father Time. Snow-white hair and feeble demeanor belie his vast knowledge. Movements are slower now, but words still poignant. Congregation is attentive and listens to every heartfelt utterance from the raspy voice. Slight shaking can be seen in his once powerful hands, muscle tone long since vanished. The solemn message is delivered more tenuously now, but never with more passion. His expression changes as glories of forever are revealed. gazing into the eyes of saints and sinners alike, making each feel the love of which he speaks. Grace personified. Children, say your prayers. A few bubbly faces happily chortle, I do, I do. Parents lovingly squeeze them and smile. The good father smiles too. Physical limitations aside, he still loves to put life in perspective each and every weekend, and the congregation still loves to hear him do it.
That's a wonderful tribute. Somehow, for yes. some reason, it sounds to me like something that could have been written in an earlier century. It's a kind mm-hmm. of dignity and...
Yes.
Yeah. Wonderful.
That one became very special to me when I figured out who it was about, like I said, for all the reasons mm-hmm. I just pointed out. This one says a lot about poetry and the fact that Ed was coming to understand the power of poetry. This poem of his is called Awesome Power of the Written Word. It can break spirit, calm fear, heal broken heart, soothe deepest ache, swell love within, answer riddle of life, glow embers red hot, show blue moon once, make envy green, give smoke flavor, motion, color, odor, make you see Anna and Bob coming and going. Let you see a feeling or feel a ceiling. Allow you to climb without a rope or fly without a net, even run the human race. Written word, powerful. And I happen to know who Anna and Bob are, and it was so fun to find this poetry in my stack. I don't believe I heard him read this at Third Stanza. I think this was shared with me by another poetry friend. Ed had presented it one night when I was not there for whatever reason, and when she sent this to me via email, I read it, and I called her up, and I said, I love this. I know Ann and Bob. That's Ann and Bob best. They're both gone. They had 8 children, wonderful Ames family, and it was part of his St. Cecilia's life and his social life. They were very social people, just mm-hmm. like Mary Susan and Ed. And I thought it was so appropriate and special that he threw them into this poem mm-hmm. because so many people in your life, that's the way you see them coming and going in whatever parts of your life they are, you know, they participate in. I knew both of them for many years at another couple from DOT, and that's quite a family there. And both unique individuals. Anne was a beautiful woman, a warm-hearted mother of their 8, both of them so proud of their 8 kids, and to have them pop up in this poem was just cool. So I hope one of the best kids is hearing this.
I'm Kay Potuck, and this is KHOI's Heart of Iowa. We're listening to local poet Maggie Westvold remembering fellow poets she's known. In the second half of this program, she'll be talking about 3 more poets, Joy Bartley, Dorothy Fife, and Mary Nakadate.
I'm going to start with Joy. I was just telling Kay, I just left my group of friends. We get together every Wednesday. That's a yarn group. We crochet and knit and spin yarn. Joy was one of us, and she's been missed very much since she passed away February 18th of 2016. She'd lived with some health problems, actually most of her adult life, heart, inner ear problems. And the last 10, 15 years of her life, she dealt with mouth cancer, ultimately died of pneumonia. All the chemo treatments and things, I think, weakened her body. And so when she became very ill, she couldn't fight that off, but left so many wonderful memories with so many people. I met her originally through the yarn group, but then when she learned that I was part of a poetry group, she said, I like poetry, I don't write very much, but I like it, can I come? So she came. She came for quite a while. Joy was a talented woman in many ways. She's very artistic. She made dolls, which she sold at art fairs. She made greeting cards, which were sold for a time at the Octagon Shop. She did beautiful wall hangings from yarn. Her yarn stash when she passed away, which her daughter, Lee, was nice enough to share with her Wednesday friends, included some of the most beautiful yarn I've ever seen because she was looking for the type that would make wall hangings. So beautiful stuff. She got back into poetry, writing haiku in the last several years. She called me one day during the winter of 2014 and 15, and she was stuck at home. We all were that day. It was some kind of a little blizzard thing. And she was going bonkers, and she wanted me to remind her how to write haiku. She couldn't remember the form, so I kind of just talked her through it, and she said, okay, now I have something to do. I won't go crazy. So she started writing haiku, and she had a spiral steno pad with a spiral across the top. And every week when she came to crochet, she would bring her haiku notebook and share, just pass it around. Nobody has to read this, but if you want to, you know, that kind of thing. And I always enjoyed reading her haiku. She had a wonderful sense of humor. She had lived such a life. There was pain from illness, pain from loss, personal loss, and always the sense of humor would come through. I'm going to first read you the bio that she wrote to go with a submittal to Haiku Journal. It's just a few lines, but this is the way she saw herself. Joy Bartley, a central Iowa poet, grew up a farm kid, then became a wife, mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother, all the while enjoying creative art, whether dolls or yarn art or greeting cards. Joy lives in Boone, Iowa, and has written poems intermittently for many years, but only recently started enjoying the challenge in penning haiku. I think I'm going to mix this up. I'm going to read you one poem that I wrote while Joy was living, and I have special memories of sharing this with Joy. I'll tell you about that after I read it. It's called Joy. I keep a special bookmark in novels I borrow from my friend Joy, to help me remember who wants it back, a necessary reminder, I'm afraid. Novels I borrow from my friend are always good ones, a plus beyond the obvious, that she's a plus in herself, as my friend, a joy of a person. Her generosity in loaning is another plus, so I try to always get her books back to their rightful owner, so she may loan again. My scrawled note on the bookmark speaks to me each time I see it. Return to Joy. Somehow I came to this poem about Joy, and when I shared that with her, she just smiled and handed it back to me and said, well, now you've got one to read when I'm gone. And I said, that is not what I had in mind, Joy. Cut that out. And she just smiled. She lived with the fear. You know, she had lived with cancer for years. Yes. So she just never thought she was. Her father is still alive. He is somewhere in the range of 100. Now I'm going to share some of Joy's haiku. There's five haiku. They're actually senryu, which is haiku is more nature oriented. Senryu is more human, people oriented, with a light bulb or catchy last line.
I think almost everyone knows what haiku are, but maybe we should just say a little bit about that.
Well, haiku, three-line poem, five beats, seven beats, and five beats. Now, this is traditional haiku. And it has a nature theme, and the last line should turn a corner or catch you off guard or, you know, kind of an aha. And that's generally the gist of haiku. Mm-hmm. Senryu, S-E-N-R-Y-U, is another Japanese form of poetry, but it's, as I said, it's human-oriented. It's more about the frailties of human life or the emotions of human life, day-to-day life. And again, at the end, kind of catches you off guard or takes you a direction you weren't expecting, maybe. The two I'm going to start with of Joy's have to do with how she saw herself as she aged. Having a birthday at this age takes lots of time, pretending I'm young. Comma-shaped am I. The mind sees a young woman, the world an old one. Right after that, I found a trio of three haiku of Joy's that such good examples of her sense of humor, which was always there. Through all those struggles, she always just kept going, always had a sense of humor. I was so happy to find, because it was just typical Joy. In another life, I want to drive a pickup with my own logo and a baseball cap, arm out the window, bopping. Won't I be so cool? Give my farmer's wave, happy as a puppy dog with head out window. So that's how I see joy now. Yeah. And then I will read to you the poem I wrote following the first Wednesday when we got together after her memorial, her funeral. I wrote this when I got home. It's called First Wednesday Without Joy. We wander, shuffle feet in a flat land, hard to wrap heads around hearts, gone. Or is it hearts around heads? Where did she go? Oh, we know, but why now? We were going to eat mashed potatoes and gravy, buy yarn, brag on beautiful grandbabies, talk yarn, read crafty magazines, share yarn art, pick apart presidential wannabes, while we create with yarn. With no joy, how can we collectively salivate over shrimp ever again? And that pretty much says who Joy was when we were together. When she was going through all the agony with the treatments for the mouth cancer, she couldn't eat for like a couple years at a time. I mean, it was bad for her.
So it was just fluids
And I think she possibly like had a port. But she couldn't eat, but she always wanted us to talk about what we had eaten. I said, Joy, you're tearing me up here. She said, I can't eat. I want to hear about your food. So we would tell her what we had to eat, and she'd say, I enjoy through you.
Well, that's right. I often hear what the desserts are at restaurants.
Yeah.
Just listening on there.
But when she could start to eat again, mashed potatoes and gravy, she could have, and she always, any restaurant we went to for lunch, she'd order a side of mashed potatoes and gravy. And I used to sit by her. She was thin. I would sit by her and always offering her some pounds because I'm always going the other direction. And I truthfully would say I am envious of you because I only get mashed potatoes and gravy at holiday time. And there's a reason that that's the way it goes. So we just miss her so much. And this has been really special to get to talk about her today. The next one will be Dorothy Fife. Dorothy became a dear, dear friend. I met her first through poetry. She also became one of the Wednesday women, the yarn group. But I met her first in a class at Ames High School, a night class in poetry. That is the predecessor of Thursdays of Poets. Dorothy died on her 80th birthday, June 8th of 2010. She was then living in Grinnell. She became a wonderful friend. We talked poetry and yarn, certainly, but she was a mentor for me as a friend and a wife and a mother, a minister. She was a minister's wife. So we talked about all those roles in life, and we talked a lot about spirituality and how we saw things, and she was a very open-minded person. She was also a retired audiologist. She had raised 4 sons. And when the boys were big enough, she went to the University of Iowa and finished her education and became an audiologist. She had lived with hearing loss her whole life, so related to that issue. She retired eventually from McFarland Clinic, worked as an audiologist in that department there. She was also a missionary child. Her parents were missionaries in Turkey, and then when she was quite young, something happened that they wanted the children to come back here and live with relatives. And Dorothy lived with I guess I'd call it anger because of their priorities. Felt that children could have come first. She said, I always felt like an outsider. And to begin with, she had the hearing loss. Then in Turkey, she was the American child of the missionaries. Then she comes back to the United States, and she is the child whose parents are the missionaries right. in Turkey, and living with family. So she never just felt like an average, normal kid. And we talked about that off and on all the years I knew her. And finally, in her last years of life, she said to me one time, I finally really like myself, Margaret. That just made me sad for her. I mean, she'd done a wonderful job of raising 4 sons. She and her husband Jim had a good life. But you carry those things with you from childhood, and she always did. But she kept it on the surface and dealt with it, and kept trying to understand all of it. She made a trip to the East Coast very late in life by herself to visit her three siblings who all had Alzheimer's. She was extremely concerned, obviously, about that being her own plight in life. She
that would be very worried.
Yes, and it was
tragic
so
in itself, and
so courageous of her to make that train. She made a train trip out and up and down the coast and visited each one of them and wrote many poems about that trip. But she wanted to see them while they knew her. And mercifully, she died of a heart problem. She did not have to deal with the Alzheimer's. So this opportunity today to read a couple of her poems is very special to me. I had just had an email from her 2 days before she died. I got the email on a Sunday night, and she said she was very tired, but what a wonderful day. Her kids had all except a couple grandkids who were in college, couldn't come, had come to help celebrate her birthday. They had a pizza party and just on and on about how wonderful. And then I opened the newspaper a couple days after her birthday, and there was the obituary. Mm-hmm. Big shock. But she got to go out on her birthday. So the first poem touches on a topic that Dee and I talked about quite often, the spirituality thing. This poem is called Refrigerator Magnets. O Sabbath rest by Galilee, O calm of hills above. Galilee, sapphire jewel in the desert, an icon for calmness, where Jesus presided over a Woodstockian picnic, said peace be still to wind and waves. Was Galilee ever calm? Did Nebuchadnezzar and Alexander detour around? Did Roman boots never trample Palestine? Crusaders and Saracens never wrangle over Jerusalem? Where is Galilee? A magnet on my refrigerator holds these lines. This is my simple religion. There is no need for temples. Our own brain, our own heart, is our temple. Where did the Dalai Lama find his Galilee? Where is my Galilee? Stanley Kunitz wrote, becoming, never being, till becoming is a being still. I found this quote on a friend's refrigerator. Education is moving forward from cocksure ignorance to thoughtful uncertainty. Maybe my job here is not to have cocksure answers, but to keep my mind thoughtful and open, to keep on asking the question, where is Galilee?
So, although she was the daughter of missionaries, she mm-hmm. wasn't conventionally religious.
No. Dee was a very open-minded, as I said, she had been the wife of a Presbyterian minister, lived that life, fulfilled her role, mm-hmm. wonderful family. But in her retirement years, and once Jim retired, she attended many different churches. She had a curious and an intelligent mind. That questioning of what it's all about, we shared that. A lot of people do, I know. What is this all about here? And she mm-hmm. constantly would bring that up and talk about it. And that's what that poem refers to. At her memorial service, the minister, a wonderful woman minister at Mayflower in Grinnell, said that not long before Dorothy's death, she had said to her, and she quoted Dorothy, and this has stuck with me, and it served me well spiritually. I live in the question with gratitude for moments of clarity. And I think maybe that's about all we can expect. That's the way I see it anyway. The other poem of hers I want to read speaks to her issues with being sent home, being a child of a missionary, and it's called Assignment. And the subtitle under Assignment says, 41 children were buried in the American Mission Cemetery near Uramaya, Iran, during the late 1800s and early 1900s. That's a quote from Gordon Taylor's Fever and Thirst. I can draw a map of the dirt road from the red gate to our kitchen door, sketch the floor plan of every room in the wing we called home, an afterthought to the stone school building. Inside my head, I see terraced vineyards and jagged peaks of perpetual snow. But ask me to describe a person who shaped my life and memory betrays me. Adults' dim voices on the fringes of my childhood. Missionary children seemed afterthoughts. Judson children left in tiny graves in Burma. Perkins children left in tiny graves in Uriah. Nielsen children left in tiny graves in Tarsus. Surviving children shipped to boarding schools, to strange relatives on the other side of the globe, while missionary parents devoted themselves to the call to bring church and civilization to people they considered lost in ignorance.
And now, these children buried in different places, they were
children of missionaries
who died of tropical diseases.
Yes, yes. And the Nielsen is her family. Mm-hmm. So.
This is actually not too dissimilar from my childhood.
Really?
I mean, my parents weren't missionaries, but my father worked for the colonial government in Africa.
Oh.
But I, you know, there were schools there. I mean, I lived there with my parents. I chose to stay at school in England. I said, I'll get a better education. Uh-huh. And you were talking about how she always felt different. Mm-hmm. Well, I sort of enjoyed being different.
Good. I mean, that's a healthier way. Since that was your life, that, yeah. Yes.
Well, I guess I wouldn't have chosen to stay.
Right. You were obviously a strong young person who set your own boundaries and made choices for yourself.
My parents gave me the choice. You know?
Yes,
and I said,
yes.
Wonderful. I'll stay here. You know?
Yeah. I don't think Dorothy ever felt she had choices. And that was where the pain was. In spite of that, she ended up, I mean, she talked warmly about her parents too, and her siblings, certainly all of them. Her family meant so much to her, but she also was determined her children would have that the kind of life she kind of wished she had had. She always told me her sons were all athletic, and she said, you know, as the wife of a minister, you move quite often sometimes. Mm-hmm. And she said the thing that saved them, every community we moved into, was athletics. They were accepted because they were athletic. That's Dorothy. To me, she was D. We had a wonderful friendship, and she used to say to me, I love that I have a young friend. I guess there were close to 20 years between us, but I always enjoyed her so much and had many wonderful talks with her. She used to really like to talk about what it had been like to be a minister's wife. Mm-hmm. Not always fun. Had nothing to do with Jim Fife. He was a great guy. I met him and had visits with him. It was just that life. It was difficult sometimes. Yes, you didn't have a lot of choices about how your day was going to go. The last, but not least by any means, the poet that I want to talk about who's left us is Mary Nakadate. Mary passed away last August. To start off with her, I would like to just read you her obituary, because I had no clue the life she had lived. We're looking at a photo, Kay and I, that with the obituary, and she was quite young in that. But
yeah, this is a photograph here on Maggie's phone. A very young-looking, laughing woman with long hair.
Yeah, she lived in downtown Ames. Walked. She did not drive in her years in Ames. She walked everywhere she went, and I know many of you would know her if you saw the photo, if you did not know her personally. Then I'm going to read this. Mary Nakadate, 72, a longtime resident of Ames, died in Beaverton, Oregon on August 8, 2016, after a long illness. Mary Margaret Ivy was born in Kilgore, Texas on December 4, 1943, to Walter William Ivy Sr. and Grace Cecilia McCoy. She was raised in Odessa and Austin, Texas, with her four siblings. She earned a bachelor's degree in English from the University of Texas at Austin in 1978, where she was elected to membership in Phi Beta Kappa. From 1960 to 67, she was married to Michael Dean of Austin. Their children were Mitchell and Ferris Dean. From 72 to 80, Mary was married to Neil Nakadate, who taught at Iowa State University. Their children were Nathaniel, Nicholas, and Laurel Nakadate. During the late 70s and early 80s, Mary worked as an emergency medical technician at Mary Greeley Medical Center in Ames. She then earned a physician's assistant degree at the University of Washington, Seattle, and practiced at Providence Medical Center in Seattle. In the late 80s, Mary moved to Port Townsend, Washington, where she worked as a writer, Reiki practitioner, and spiritual healer. During this time, she began to study the writings of Rudolf Steiner and became a dedicated student of anthroposophy. In the early 1990s, she returned to Ames, where she was an active member of the Rudolf Steiner study group, bringing many important speakers on anthroposophy to Ames.
I guess that it's sort of etymologically that means the truth about human beings, about
okay, thank you. Thank you. She was also closely involved with the beginning stages of the Prairie Flower Children's Center, Ames's Waldorf Preschool. Mary had a lifelong dedication to spirituality and religion, and she graduated from Santa Sophia Seminary in Tahlequah, Oklahoma, where she was ordained in 1998. While living in Ames, Mary was a member of Unity Church and appreciated for her spiritual generosity and selflessness, her devotion to friends and family, and her abundant faith. I learned many things in that obituary that I had no idea she had experienced in her life. I enjoyed her so much after she joined us. I'm going to say she was with us about 5 to 7 years. Such a gift to Third Stanza poets, because she came in with a distinctive writing style and a voice that paired with that writing so well. I have the honor of reading a poem today, but I told her one time, no one else should ever read your poetry, because her voice was like a chant you would hear in a cathedral. Her writing, that's the first time I'd ever known anyone that I had heard people talk about channeling before, but Mary's writing and the way she talked about her spirituality, and she said a lot of this writing, the things that she shared with us, she said it started coming out of me after 9/11. And she said, I have a suitcase full of it. I felt that she was somehow channeling God's wisdom. That's what her writing was like. So today, I'm going to try and do justice and read one of her poems. I remember hearing her read this one at one of our 11 days readings. Every September for about close to 10 years, we have done, Third Stanza has done a reading at Cafe Diem, who's been good enough to host us every year. I can see and hear Mary Nakadate reading this poem that I'm going to read today, the year that she read it. It's called Open Your Arms. It makes no sense to count the children of adversity. They are legion, and they live in Tupelo, Mississippi. It makes no sense to count the children of disaster. They are legion, and they live in Uganda. Do not count the children of apocalypse, or your arms will fill to overflowing with those heaps of smoking white bones, buffeting the edges of your heart, dusting your flesh with ashes, and you will not stop crying. You cannot count them, the children of apocalypse. They are burned beyond recognition, like the earth that sustained them, a jumble, a heap of dust and ashes, steamed bones and flesh non-existent. They are legion, and sifted to ashes and heaps of smoking bones in Afghanistan and Syria and Somalia, in Nagasaki and Hiroshima. If you want to see, look in those round eyes. If you want to feel, touch those round arms. Tiny arms, a jumble in a universe of questions. Tiny soft flesh shaped into arms and legs and faces with questions unanswered. It makes not sense to count the children of apocalypse. I am a mother, and they are all mine. My arms enfold them, filling with the tears of yesterday, filling with the cries of tomorrow, filling with the blood of today. Running down these arms, tears, blood, and chaos. Listen to history. Hear the cries, after cries echoing guns, never silent. When will we count the children of apocalypse? When these arms can no longer hold them? I am a mother, and my arms are filled with ashes. I wish you could have heard that in Mary's voice. She had a resonance and a belief in what she was saying that came through strongly, very strongly. That is my segment on Mary Nakadate.
These are wonderful, Maggie. You've known these people for years. A long life you've had with them.
Yeah.
And they're giving the fruits of their lives, their long lives. The length of time you know them and the wisdom mm-hmm. in which you see them is very valuable, I feel.
We've been hearing Maggie Westfold, a poet from Ames and a president of Third Stanza Poetry Society, talking about deceased fellow poets she's been close to, about their work and about their relationships. And now, until next time, goodbye from the heart of Iowa.